The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between David Flink, founder and chief empowerment officer of I2I, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
There are 2.4 million public school students who have been identified with learning disabilities. As a result, just 68% of these students earn high school diplomas versus 91% of their peers. An organization led by two individuals who encounter some of these challenges themselves is making a big difference in the lives of these young people. It's called Eye to Eye, and it's a pleasure to have David Flink, their chief empowerment officer, and Marcus Sutra, who serves as president, with us tonight. Good evening, gentlemen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having us.
As I mentioned, both of you experienced learning disabilities growing up. Let me start with you, David, and ask you to tell us about the challenges of learning differently and how you went on to successfully navigate this path, which included graduating from Brown University.
So I grew up in 1980, and there was a lot that wasn't known. So for the first good chunk of my childhood, I knew there was something different. I could feel it, right? Like kids were learning to read and I wasn't. I also have ADHD, so kids were sitting still and focusing, and it was quite obvious that I wasn't. And the gift that happened in fifth grade was that someone sat down and said, something's not right, and it's not that David's stupid. And so my life actually changed because I actually got diagnosed. I now like the word identified because it's part of my identity.
Yeah.
But I got these labels, this understanding that I was dyslexic and ADHD. And I went through the rest of my schooling, and I had hit the parent lottery and the teacher lottery. And I got teachers who understood me and gave me what I needed, parents who gave me a lot of love, and I did go to Brown. As I went to Brown, the one thing that was really clear to me is even though I had all of this community of adults, I didn't have any real role models, any near-peer relationships of people who learned and thought like I did. So when I got to Brown, I said, okay, I'm going to figure this out. Mm-hmm. Step one is I need to find some other people on campus who have dyslexia and ADHD and other types of learning disabilities because I need community. Step two, I have a responsibility to give back. So I went to a local elementary school and middle school, and I said, okay, like, show me your dyslexic ADHD kids. And, you know, again, this is like late 80s, early 90s. They didn't ask for any background checks or who the heck I was. They said, here they are. And we started hanging out with little kids, and we built a community.
Yeah. And let me ask you about dyslexia. What exactly is it?
So dyslexia is based in your brain. It's a disability where the way in which your brain decodes letters is different than other people who don't have dyslexia. So literally when I look at a letter and I try and decode what that sound is, it takes a circuitous route in my brain to be able to get to that answer. So that's the reason why people who have dyslexia often struggle with decoding words or spelling words, because they're having trouble making that connection. One of the things I would actually add is an interesting part about what is dyslexia. That circuitous route, that different thinking brain, also has unleashed a lot of creative thinking, a lot of problem-solving skills that other people don't have. So dyslexia is an interesting paradox of a struggle with one thing, and also there's a lot of research now to say a gift with another.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag.
It's a mixed
bag. No question about it.
In school, it's definitely often perceived of as a challenge.
Yeah. Marcus, tell us your story.
Yeah, my story is a little similar to Dave. I was identified with dyslexia and ADHD. They came together around third grade, and I found school to be an incredible struggle, and really didn't have any role models, and really didn't have any kind of sense that, you know, there was people with learning disabilities that were going on to college and being successful. We didn't have the out and proud celebrities that exist today with learning disabilities that we had when I was a kid, and so the message was clear: like, do not talk about this, don't embrace help, don't ask for accommodations, like, just basically try and tough it out throughout school. And luckily, I would go home every night to, as the parent lottery, as Dave put it, and had parents who were incredibly inspiring and motivating. And so I felt very intelligent throughout my school experience, but I didn't feel school was embracing that intelligence well. And so I said to myself, what could be the way that I could actually be effective in supporting kids? And so I went on to become a teacher. And I thought, okay, I'll be the teacher who understands these kids on a different level, you know, can differentiate the instruction, attention, be more empathetic to their struggles, whatever it is. But I'm not going to tell anybody I have a learning disability, that's for sure, because that was something I was not comfortable with. But I did know that it was going to inform the way I taught in the classroom. And then sure enough, a couple of weeks into my actually student teaching, before I even got my first job teaching, I started misspelling everything on the board, and my kids called me out on it. And as the way 16-year-olds can. And,
oh, yeah.
They will call you on your stuff, you know, right away. And so I realized that I had to embrace it. I had to tell them my story. And then I saw my story as a tool and as a way to change the culture of that classroom. And it was – the kids were embracing their accommodations. The kids were – it normalized something that was really heavy and embarrassing and stigmatized for a lot of kids. And I started thinking, how do you scale this experience? Mm-hmm. And that's when Dave and I very fortuitously got connected by a professor of mine at Keene State, who was kind of nurturing me in my first couple years of my career, and checking in with him. And because I was always good at finding mentors. That's something I always was really good about. And he said, this guy, Dave, he's running this thing. It was at Brown. And I heard him speak at this conference. I don't think he has a budget or an office or anything, but you should. Maybe, I think he might have a website.
And you know? Still called him up.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I called him. I picked up the phone, and sure enough, Dave was the one answering the phone at the time. And and I said, dude, what you're doing sounds really cool. And I'm doing something kind of similar in my one classroom. Mm-hmm. And we should get coffee. And we began a monthly chat. And then I started working, doing I'll volunteer, Dave. I'll do whatever needs to be done. And after that first year of teaching, I moved to New York in 2007 to work in Dave's apartment and really begin to kind of combine what Dave had learned from his experience at Brown and his education background in philosophy and my practice background at Keene State and what I had done in the classroom, and said, okay, let's combine these two experiences and build an organization together.
And listening to you two guys, David, it really just seems that you learn differently. And I think there's a lot of people think we just learn one way or a couple different ways, but you've done a lot of research on this. Tell us about the different ways that we all learn.
Yeah, I really feel that we need to reframe learning for our next generation. To your point, I think we've thought about learning as this way, you open the head, you deposit the knowledge, you close the head, you're done. And of course, we actually know some of the most powerful learning experiences that we have in life are ones that happen outside the classroom or outside the sort of traditional form.
You're absolutely
so,
right.
So, I mean, no question I learned differently, and I'd actually argue that so do you, so does Marcus, so does our guy in the booth here. Mm-hmm. Thank you for editing, right? Everyone's doing something different. And so the actual excitement, and I think it's a human excitement when we can experience seeing somebody else's learning style, appreciating it, and feeding into it. And this can be a whole plethora. It can be interpersonal learning. It can be auditory learning. It can be experiential learning. And it might be, by the way, sort of sitting down, listening to a lecture and receiving knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's all good, too. The soul lights up. And we've all seen this and experienced it. And so I optimize in my life and also in my work to help those experiences happen more readily for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Marcus, tell us about Eye to Eye and what the organization specifically does to try to help these young people with these learning disabilities.
Sure. So Eye to Eye is really trying to solve the equity issue. It's in our education system. We do not have an equal playing field for all students and all learners. And so what we're trying to do is really improve the life outcomes of students with learning disabilities specifically. And they are the population that is dropping out at a rate 3 times of their peers. They're showing signs of depression at earlier ages. They're getting suspended, ending up in juvenile justice system. One study out of Texas showed that 50% of the inmates in prison in Texas had learning disabilities.
Wow.
So we really wanted to make sure that we could try and solve this problem. So the core of what we do is a mentoring program. We organize high school and college students with learning disabilities themselves, dyslexia, ADHD, other types of learning issues, and bring them into middle schools and use a social-emotional curriculum to teach younger students with learning disabilities about how they learn, teaching them, giving them a sense of community, really helping them advocate for themselves and their needs. That's such a huge component of this, that the research really shows us that if these students can advocate for themselves and their needs, that they can be successful regardless of the learning environment they're in. Learning keeps changing based on the environment that you're in. Learning is just a social construct like any other. And if you're able to advocate for yourself throughout high school, college, or the workplace, you're going to be much more successful.
Yeah.
So then we also do kind of broader outreach work. So we'll do community events to bring resources, speakers, knowledge to the communities who maybe don't have the mentoring program. The mentoring program currently is in 24 states at about 170 schools around the country. We also brought our curriculum onto an app format. So people people can access Eye2Eye completely for free in their phones. So you just go to the App Store and type in Eye2Eye Empower, and you can download it there. And we also do kind of what we would call representation work or community building work. So we'll do a billboard series in Times Square for Disability Awareness Month with our students being the face cool. of learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. Or we'll appear on TV or PSAs at sporting events. And we'll also partner with organizations that do policy work. We were just recently on the Hill with our students advocating for the policies that are affecting their lives every day. So really bringing the face and voice to the movement as well as bringing this in-school intervention piece.
And arts would be at the heart of this mentor program.
Yeah, it's a project-based learning, but if you walked into any one of our schools, any one of our programs, it's really art projects. I can give you an example of one.
Please do.
Yeah. So one of my favorite ones is, when I was a kid, and a lot of kids are very popular superheroes right now, right? So Batman has his utility belt. He has all these things. No matter what happens to Batman, he seems to have something on his tool belt to solve it. And so what we build with our kids is our mentors come into the school and say, okay, we are kids with learning disabilities. We learn differently. We're going to need some tools to succeed in school. And so let's build utility belts, our own learning belts, essentially. And on those belts, these kids build things to help them with their spelling, things to keep them on time, something to be able to listen to their audio books. When we started off doing this, it was more physical things. And now it's basically a series of apps that kids would be able to utilize. But it gets the kid to talk about their challenges, talk about the economy. Accommodations that are supporting them in school, and really kind of see that near peer role model, somebody who's just a little bit older than them, who's got some tips, some tricks to help them get through school. So really the art kind of breaks down that barrier and helps build that relationship.
Yeah, so workarounds and skills as to how to accommodate a society that sometimes is not all that accommodating.
Yeah. I mean, we wish school would be perfect, and one day maybe it will be, but until that day, we're going to give the kids the tips and tricks and strategies so that they can be successful in an environment that is broken and not fit for them.
Yeah. I can hear you guys want to change the culture of school, and that's really at the heart of a lot of it. Well, what's the impact of this program? Do you have outcomes in terms of these mentees who have been through your program?
Yeah, I think, perhaps with my theory background, like, research was super important from the get-go. So we've been doing research on our work for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And actually this month, we have a partnership most recently with a multi-year study done by UCSF out of California.
Yeah.
And this month, a peer-reviewed journal published this multi-year study. And what we found is that as we show up in these schools, these kids learn how to advocate for themselves, as Marcus was describing, and their grades go up, their depression goes down.
Mm.
I mean, the outcomes that often lead kids to prison are now reversed and are leading them to graduating from high school, college, and beyond. And so as I think about really what is now a moral responsibility, that this 20 years of work has said, your work works and it can change kids' lives. I mean, Marcus and I spend a lot of time thinking about, now we have this undeniable responsibility to scale this work. And so, the vast majority of time that we spend together thinking is, okay, it's terrific. We're doing a lot of really, really good work. But we know, as you began, like, there's 2.4 million kids out there. How are we going to get there? And we actually are very excited that we have a line of sight to solving that problem within the next 10 years.
Well, let's hear that line of sight, because I think one of the biggest challenges that the entire sector has is how to scale efficiently and effectively and quickly. And it seems that we have so many answers to so many problems, but we can't get them out there at scale. Tell us a little bit about that line of sight and what you plan on doing.
So I'll tell you where we're headed, and I'll tell you how we'll get there.
Okay.
So where we're headed is in the next 10 years, we're going to be in 50% of all schools in America serving middle schools who have these kids with diagnosed learning disabilities. And the way we're going to get there is, what we realize is, our volunteer corps, these young people, are actually the solution.
Mm.
And we often think about young people as problems to solve. In our case, and I think actually in most cases, these young people have the solution. They are the near-peer relationships. So we've now figured out, because of this incredible, force of young people who are willing to share their stories and time, that we can get into schools by finding these high school students. We're basically a great recruitment program is what we are now, because we already have the curriculum. So we recruit these young people, we teach them how to be mentors, and we're scaling them to go to their local communities, schools that they know. Sharing their stories and working now, more extensively also with teachers so that they feel empowered. I think a lot of the magic of Eye2Eye has been to empower the young students to be able to say, I need this to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
But then also the teachers and the parents be able to say, that's okay. You said school culture. half of the challenge is just to normalize that relationship, that exchange. Because what's happening right now is even in the best case scenario where a kid says, I need this, well-intentioned adults say, you shouldn't do it that way, right?
Right.
And interestingly, when you get out of school using, say, an app to help you find directions or to remember something is okay, when you get into school, you have to remember all this stuff and, you know, it's like crazy to me. So we're normalizing that culture in schools and we're going to get there.
Yeah. Marcus, do a lot of the mentees ultimately become mentors?
Yeah, when you're getting as old as Dave and I are. I think that's one of the most kind of inspiring and beautiful things about this work is that our program team will go into a school and say, why are you choosing to volunteer? And, you know, every year more and more we're hearing students say, oh, well, I was a mentee in this program and now I'm ready to give back. And we have mentors who go on and say, I'm not done giving back. I want to be a teacher and work in the schools and continue this work in my own classroom, which is really, really exciting when you think about scale of our mentees going on to be the leaders in education that we need to be able to transform these systems. So that's something that's been really exciting to see over the years as our mentees going on. And one of the wonderful things we do is when all of our students graduate from high school or from college is they get to wear an IDI cord when they graduate. We mail that to them. And this year we had a giant box that we got to mail out to all the students who are graduating. And, you know, a lot of our students aren't wearing the honor cords because they're not summa cum laude, which is fine as far as I'm concerned, but they are wearing their IDI cord when they graduate. And every year that box that we mail out in the spring gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's wonderful. David, you have written a book called Thinking Differently, An Inspiring Guide to Parents and Children with Learning Disabilities. So let's talk a little bit about the parents. What advice do you have for them?
So I think number one is, you know, almost similar to Mark's story, maybe even a bit more than mine, is parents need to feel comfortable with the idea that these labels aren't bad things. And half of the choice to write this book and to share my journey and also the journey of many, many other students who came through IDI was to really help parents feel it's okay to say these words out loud, to tell them to your kids, and to help these kids find their community. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what is in that book is giving parents the tools to be able to do that for their kids. Because like Marcus said, we're not going to be able to be in every community, but we can inspire every community to see greatness in young people.
Marcus, tell us a little bit more about that app, that website. I mean, how people can access some of this information before you get to them.
Yeah, definitely. So the app is the freest and fastest way to get involved with I2I right now. And we were really thinking about how can we make sure that what we've learned from our program, what we've learned from this study with UCSF can get to more individuals. It's not the same as having a mentor in your life, but it is something that everybody can access, which is so important to us. So the app is a series of quests kind of similar to based on the art projects or project-based learning that we do in schools where students identify their strengths. Their weaknesses, what accommodations they need, helps them with their goal setting. And then what students in schools right now have is, for people who don't know, they have an IEP or a 504. That's mm-hmm. their legal document that guarantees them the rights to be in school, get extended time on tests, a note taker, use audiobooks, whatever that accommodation would be. The same thing with a student who might need a ramp to get into a building. You know, students might need an audiobook to listen to a book. So every year there's a meeting with the family, the parents, the teachers, the principals, whoever, to make sure this document is correctly put together. And what the app does is prepare the student to be involved in that meeting. Because mm-hmm. so often the students have been siloed and not a part of that conversation.
Yeah, you're right.
And then they're told, hey, you better advocate for yourself. And it's like, well, I haven't been given the tools or the strategies on how to do that. So the app actually, after you're done going through all the, I believe it's 8 quests that the students go through, it collects all that data, aggregates it, and puts it into a PDF that you can, an 11-page document that you can share with your teachers, your parents, your whoever, your case manager, and now gives that student a voice in that meeting, whether they're there physically or not. So it's really preparing them to be able to advocate for their legal rights.
Mm-hmm. Good
and,
stuff.
And you know, it's interesting, you're probably getting a sense of how the two of us work together. So Marcus and his team created the app, and me and my team created the book. And the book is the blueprint for the parents, and the app is the blueprint for the kids. And then, of course, all that is working in concert with the school. So we're really just trying to come in a holistic way and support these communities because we know everybody can succeed. We just got to give everybody the right frame and tools to be able to do that.
Well, that's about the cleanest division of labor I think I've ever heard.
It's not always
so. I know what I do.
Thank you. I'm so glad we came on your show so we could clear that all up.
We've been working here for 12 years without a job.
Yeah, no, here we go. We got it.
Marcus was looking like, really? That's what we're doing? So you have a very interesting place in which to work. Tell us a little bit about the corporate culture, Dave.
So it's interesting, right? You heard Marcus at the beginning saying we were working out of my apartment. That's true. It's over in Tompkins Place in Brooklyn. You can go check it out. Not many people want to. Once we moved out
nice
of it, I mean, it's a nice neighborhood, but there's no reason why you'd go look at some apartment that Dave and Marcus worked out of. As soon as we had literally a staff of three, we said, okay, we have to pay attention to the same advocacy that we're instilling in our schools, helping people work in a way that optimizes for their learning. We have to do in our workplace. And so everything that we advocate for in our schools, we do in our workplace. So just like our community, although we over-index in people who learn and think differently, since we are for and by people who learn and think differently, our employees, about 75%, have things like dyslexia and ADHD. And so we create the same as we ask for in schools, work IEPs, environments where people can say, hey, you know, I learn better this way or that way. And we try and frame for each person a model for which they can succeed. And it's been very exciting to see, you know, articles in Forbes celebrating us as one of the best places to work and getting like the best in the top 10 nonprofits to work at and things like that. Because all we really did was say, hey, you know, I'm going to need this accommodation. Like, I'm dyslexic. So if you send me like a long memo, I'm probably not going to read it. But if you let me, you know, have it in an audio format, I will. That's not a hard accommodation. It's exactly what we asked for in school. So it's now, you know, companies are coming and asking us, hey, like, can you come over to Goldman Sachs and help us think a bit about it? Turns out, especially people on the trading floor have a lot of ADHD. What do we need to do to make sure that they succeed? And we're really just playing the same game that we've been playing in school in the workforce. And, you know, in America, we need to make sure we have a workforce that can succeed. And that means the same things we're trying to do in school have to pertain to what people show up in the workplace today.
Absolutely. And it's always so nice when your culture is aligned with the actual work you do during the day. And you don't find that alignment in a lot of organizations. Well, both of you have great stories. Marcus, share with us a story of someone who's been through your program and the difference that it's made in their lives.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many stories. I'll think about one that we just had an event out in San Francisco, and we honored one of our alumni. And her name is Vanessa Montgomery, and she lives in San Diego. And I think about Vanessa, not only was she in our program, but she's now an educator herself, kind of what I was speaking about before, that she has not just embraced eye to eye in the program, but is living eye to eye throughout her entire life. And so Vanessa was a student out there in the San Diego area working with eye to eye, and now is a teacher who's running her own learning disability conferences at the school, getting other teachers trained, giving them the knowledge to be able to do their work. You know, she's brought her own story as a perspective of how she teaches and how she lives in the classroom. So she's not only a symbol of success, but she's bringing all that she's learned about being a professionally trained educator and, you know, the work that she's done, you know, at eye to eye into the classroom. And that's something that's really exciting, I think, for Dave and I to think about somebody who will probably be around after we're gone, who's still doing this work and not just like not just a one-off. And I think that that's something that's really important when we think about the work that eye to eye is doing, a lot of other amazing organizations, that it's not just like the one-day fundraiser or the car wash or whatever it is, that like this is something that these people are doing every single week in schools. Our students will do over 100,000 hours of community service this
That's
year.
Great.
And you know, being able to then carry on and kind of live that as a part of their life and not just a one experience they had for a year in college.
And I would add actually just an additional piece. I mean, to see mentee go to mentor, and then in the case of Vanessa, becoming a teacher. But also, you know, we have alumni, some of whom sit on our board, who've been through the entire program, and now they're giving philanthropically to support the organization. We have alumni who've, you know, worked in startups, a couple that I won't mention by name, but let's just say they've gone IPO'd recently, and they're very public about their learning and attention issues, and that's changing culture and big business. I mean, what's exciting is to not just see these mentees become mentors and graduate, but to see that they are taking their stories as a community into wherever they go and creating change.
That's great. Let me close with this for both of you, and that is for a young person with dyslexia or ADHD or some other learning disability, what word of encouragement would you be able to give them to inspire them to forge ahead? Dave?
What word of encouragement? I mean, I think they have to understand that they are part of one of the largest hidden minorities in our country, right? They are 1 in 5 people in America. And because we are told that it's a disability and it's something you shouldn't talk about, you can't find your community. So my first word of encouragement is tell someone, right? If you start with just telling your story, guaranteed 1 in 5 people are going to give you a high five. I remember when we first started, I didn't know how to find other people. I literally made T-shirts. I would walk around and say, like, this is what dyslexia looks like.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden people would come up to me and say, hey, that's me. I mean, some of them were a little more eye-catching. I said, you know, I put the sexy in dyslexia. We don't make that one anymore. But I found a lot of people that way. Whatever it takes to tell your story, that's step one. The rest will follow.
Mm-hmm. Advertising is really important.
It makes a big difference. Turns out. It's the same reason why we do billboards in Times Square. You can do it in Times Square, yep, or you can do it in your local community by just telling your story.
Yeah, and it also puts you at ease once mm-hmm. you get it out there because you're not trying to cover it up anymore.
That's
and
right.
You can just be yourself. Marcus, what would you add?
I mean, I think the loneliness piece is something that a lot of – anyone who has a hidden disability or a hidden difference of any kind, I think it feels very, very alone. And I think that there's value in not only you sharing your story, as Dave was saying, to benefit somebody else, but it does benefit you as well. And it does allow you to feel more comfortable in this space, and it allows you to be more successful. If you're working in an office right now and you're like, man, if I only had X, Y, and Z, I could be more successful, you need to talk to your boss about that. You need to advocate to HR about those things because they want you to be successful. They're, you know, and they're going to most likely, unless it's a really place we probably shouldn't be working, they're going to embrace that because they're going to want you to be successful at the end of the day. So I think just understanding that you're not alone and that by telling your story, you can not only change someone else's life, but you can also change yours.
Can I actually insert an additional thing around people who are a little older?
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking before we got on the air about Vanessa Kirsch, founder of New Profit, one of our board members, one of the first supporters of IDI. And I remember when I first met Vanessa, you know, what I said to her is like, obviously, you have a great lens in terms of how to scale nonprofits. And for those listening who haven't heard that interview, you should go back and listen to the New Profit interview. It's terrific. But one of the things that I said to Vanessa, I said, look, I happen to know you're dyslexic. Like, I've seen you talk about it. But, like, I don't see you talk about it that often. And they hold this big gathering. Some of the leading social entrepreneurs and business people come to that gathering. And I said, you know, I'd be excited to work with you and think about how to scale eye to eye. But what I want you to do next, if you're willing, is at that next gathering, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people from around the world come to this. Start the gathering by saying, hey, I'm Vanessa Kirsch and I'm dyslexic. And raise your hand if you are too. And she said, I hadn't thought about that. I was like, all the philanthropy you do in the world is going to be great. But if you do that, it's going to change things. And she got up the next, you know, however many weeks or months later, I remember, and did that. And guess what? Like, one in five people raised their hand. And actually, I think we over-indexed in the social entrepreneurship sector. So I think it was even more.
Entrepreneurship completely.
Yeah. I think one in three CEOs in America and Fortune 500 companies are dyslexic. So, you know, telling your story at a young age is important, and continuing to tell it is also important.
Super. Well, David Flink, CEO, and Marcus Sutra, president of Eye to Eye. I want to thank you both for being here tonight. Hey, David, tell listeners about your website and some of those tools that are out there that can help them right away.
So I hope you'll visit eyetoeyenational.org, where we have resources that we've mentioned on the show, the app, my book, also a film which we didn't discuss called Road Trip Nation, which is a great film to just sit down and watch with your kids. It's the story of young people going through America, meeting successful adults who have learning and attention issues. You can also go to davidflink.com to learn a bit more about me. And I would say there's while you're on the IDI website, you should go and check out our diplomats. We didn't touch on it too much, but just to end there, our diplomats are a group of trained young people who can come into your schools, share their stories, and start to set the conversation in motion. So eyetoeyenational.org and davidflink.com.
Well, I want to thank you both. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.